Doc Severinsen is a trumpet player who rose to fame as the sharply dressed band leader on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Here is Doc and all the guys doing Last Tango in Paris.
And now, at 90, he still travels around the country performing with a vocalist from Kansas. Vanessa Thomas is the musician's musician. She's sultry on stage, and she's got a 4-octave vocal range that will knock you out. She was classically trained from an early age, then she lived and worked in New York in her late teens. Now she's living her dream life, touring the country as a performer with a home base here in Lawrence and 4 kids of her own. But her story begins humbly in rural Kansas with some really hefty obstacles to overcome. We're going to hear that story on KCUR's Central Standard. Vanessa Thomas, good morning.
Good morning.
You talk about living your dream life now. Can you explain what that means to you?
Well, for me, it means a lot of things that I always wanted, I now have. For one thing, being adopted, I always had a dream of having my own children. And I have 4 wonderful kids, and we have a great time. It's a busy, crazy, hectic life, but I really have enjoyed, being a mom. And then the second part of my dream is, of course, being able to support myself with a career in music. So I feel very lucky that I have both things in my life that I had always wanted.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yes, it's kind of great.
You grew up in Clay Center, Kansas?
Yes.
What is that community like?
Well, Clay Center, when I try to describe it to people, to be honest, I don't think they actually believe me. It's a little farming community. It's very rural. I think the population is about 5,000. And, it never grows and it never shrinks. It's 5,000. So growing up in Clay Center, I was one of just a couple children of color. And my dad used to farm. And so my parents both grew up on farms when they were kids. And it's just a really tight-knit community where you might walk down Main Street and everyone speaks to you and actually says, "Hi, Vanessa." I would say, "Hi, Mr. or Mrs.," and I knew their name.
So not just a nod.
No, it's really...
Which we think we're pretty friendly for the smile and nod here in Kansas City.
Oh, yes. But it's a couple levels up from that. So there's that aspect of it, just being a really small town and, all of the things a small town in the Midwest might bring. But also, it's a really unexpected place culturally. Because I grew up and was surrounded by the arts, and I didn't know any differently. Like, I just thought other communities must be like this, too.
That is certainly not the stereotype of growing up in a farming community.
Definitely not. Definitely not. And, we had an active arts council in the town, and a lot of acts that were coming through to Kansas City or Manhattan or, any of the larger towns, Salina even, we would get them in Clay Center on their way to something. So I grew up listening to a lot of live music and live concerts in our town. Like, we didn't have to travel necessarily to hear quality music.
Although, something you just said is sort of sweet and also sad, that you heard live music, but that they were on their way somewhere.
Exactly.
Like, that Clay Center wasn't somewhere.
Well, I'm sure when you're planning your tour schedule, you look at the major cities and states like Kansas City. Let's stop there. Clay Center would not be on your radar. It's a town of 5,000. How could they afford to pay? But there were a lot of obstacles that just got met in Clay Center because people were hungry for the culture and they were used to it. It was their standard.
Well, you've mentioned that you were there with your adoptive family, that you had been adopted, and I have read a little bit about your personal history. There's a really difficult chapter early on that explains both how you ended up in Clay Center and what drew you to music.
Yes. It's an interesting story that I sometimes, because I don't have these memories about my story early on.
Because it's so early.
It was very early. I don't know. And, you know, even my adoptive family, who I just refer to as my family,
right,
because they're the ones that did all the work and gave me all the love. But, you know, they don't know every detail either. I came to them at 6 or 8 months, and they were foster parents. And this was really back before the days of you gaining anything from being a foster parent. My parents just wanted to help. They had a lot of love. They had 5 children of their own who were grown. Almost grown. I think my youngest brother was maybe 15 when I came to live with them. And so this is just something they wanted to do. And so we don't know all of the details of what happened to me and why I was brought to their home. But I do know that in most of my infant pictures, I have a cast on my leg, and it was a foot cast that went all the way up, you can see, to my above my knee. So I had some broken bones. And part of the story unfolds because I kept going back to my biological parents for visits occasionally. And each time that would happen, I would have more abuse.
So like you would come back to your foster parents with physical signs of having been harmed?
Correct. Or I wouldn't be able to come back. I'd have to go to the hospital.
Oh, my gosh.
With, you know, like a social worker or something. So I look at all of these details, the ones that I do have on paper, in files, and it seems like such a crazy story. It can't be mine. But it really did happen. And, you know, I've never looked at it as any sort of like victimization just because I have no memories of it. Now, that doesn't mean that I didn't experience the trauma and that it didn't take time to process. But, you know, it's almost a no man's land. Like, what do you do with that when you can't vocalize it, or you can't understand the feelings that you have inside, or, you know, something like that? And
What is your earliest awareness of wrestling with that?
I remember almost nothing until age 4. And around age 4 is when it all kind of came to fruition, and I was to be adopted. Finally, that happened, and the state of Kansas stepped in, and my case actually went to the Kansas Supreme Court. And so I remember that year, at some point, I was very nervous all the time because I knew that I wanted to stay where I was with my family, you know, and my mom and dad wanted to adopt me. And I called them mom and dad, and I didn't know any other mom and dad. And I had this family of 4 brothers and a sister, and I was home, but I knew that there was a possibility that I wouldn't get to stay. So that's really the earliest memory I have of wrestling with my feelings. I would go to the grocery store with mom, and, you know, people would say hi, as they do in Clay Center, hi, you know. and then I would hide. I remember running to hide behind her and, you know, say things like, are they going to take me, you know?
Aww.
Why are they talking to us? And so that was maybe more traumatic, you know, and cemented in my brain than the other actual physical events that took place.
Is this part of what brought you to music?
I think there was never a separation for me between myself and music. To me, since I had been such a survivor and you know, almost dying several times, I made a way somehow in my brain and in my life, in my tiny little baby toddler life.
So almost dying several times, you're saying that that's the level of...
The abuse was quite bad 2 or 3 times. And I think at maybe the second or third point, they said, you know, this has to stop or she's not going to make it next time. So it sort of, I think it escalated. And again, I don't know a lot of details, but I know that the last time it was quite bad, and that's what prompted the state to step in. But, you know, not having these concrete feelings, I just made a way to adapt and survive. And whatever that was in my toddler brain, it kept me going for a long time. And so I didn't have, you know, horrible emotions on a daily basis. I had a fantastic childhood. I was very happy. I remember finding out that my parents could adopt me, and I jumped up and down and I said, yay, I can stay with you, Mom and Dad. But that being said, there would be times when a torrent of emotion would come out, and I just didn't know what that was. You know, what are these feelings, I guess, because in general, I felt very little. I was kind of a numb, even keel. I kept things pretty home base. So I think that music came to me as the only way that I could express myself, meaning I never stopped singing. I never stopped going to the piano to make songs. It was just how I communicated.
Can you remember how music felt to you then?
It was, well, goosebumps. You know, when your hair stands on end in a good way and you get goosebumps, that's how I've always felt when I sing.
Just going way, way back to when you were tiny.
Exactly.
So, but thinking of music as sort of a way of channeling those major torrents of emotion when they would happen, did that evolve from just doing that naturally to doing that more consciously and deliberately as you got older? Or is it more that music evolved into this more kind of structured, formal study?
Wow, that's a good question. You know, I think what happened is I had that natural release of emotion when I was younger. And as I got older, like into my teen years, I wanted to be more reserved and not share as much of my soul with people. Which
a lot of teenagers go the other direction.
Yes, yes. So I went through that little phase. And, you know, of course, that's never what people want to see from you on stage, is only half of yourself or, you know, none of your soul. That's what art is. That's what makes it so moving, is to see a glimpse of someone's soul. And so at some point in my late teens, when I was in New York, it just came back to me. And I was able to be comfortable enough to release my emotions through singing.
There are pieces of this story that I feel like we've kind of like jumped over. I mean, you've talked about growing up in Clay Center, and you've talked about your family arrangements and how you had this really, it sounds like, a great family once
Yes.
you were truly at home and could leave the limbo of back and forth with the biological family behind. But you've also mentioned that you were one of the few people of color in Clay Center.
Yes.
Can you tell me more about that aspect of your upbringing?
Well, it's kind of interesting that I would learn about our nation's history in school. And, you know, to be honest, I really thought that I was just like everyone else in town. And no one made me feel that I wasn't. I mean, it was a very rare instance that I ever felt singled out for any reason. Everyone just kind of embraced me in the community.
What is your cultural heritage?
I am African-American and white. So I'm mixed. And, you know, I know that if you look at me, I don't look white. But, you know, there's more to my identity than being brown also.
Yeah.
But yeah, the community was really great. And I like to think that music paved the way for that, because I'm sure that, you know, in any tiny rural farming community, there could be ignorance or there could be racism that exists and has for, you know, many centuries probably. But I really did not experience that in any real way. And so I was completely sheltered from that. And when I went out into the real world, I started realizing, oh, wow, yeah, you know, people see me as a Black woman. Okay.
What did that feel like? I mean, what form did that take?
Well, I think their expectations of me were different than the me that I gave them. For instance, I didn't sing jazz growing up. I did listen to a lot of styles of music because my parents were avid music listeners and lovers. And my mom's favorite was classical music. And so every time public television was on, we were going to watch her Pavarotti. And so I grew up listening to Pavarotti and Domingo and all of the great opera singers, Beverly Sills. And so when people met me, they expected me to perhaps be a jazz singer or to have a focus in singing spirituals, African-American spirituals. And none of that I did until, you know, later on. And now I sing a lot of jazz. But I think, you know, people have an idea when they see me what I will be like. And I'm just me. I'm Vanessa from a small town farming community. And
it sounds like that's how you were able to grow up, too.
Yeah, it was a wonderful childhood. And, you know, I had the open sky and I could play in the yard. I could go around the community with my friends. We had a pretty sweet deal in Clay Center.
The aspect of Clay Center being this sort of surprisingly cultural spot, how did that happen?
Well, this is a detailed story. So I will drop a few names. So the Snodgrass family in Clay Center was the music family and still is. They still have a segment of family members there. And so my music mentor was C.L. Snodgrass. His father had been the band director before him, and my mother had Wayne Snodgrass as her band director. And he assembled a stage band. And so the orchestra members assembled with the jazz players, and they did a pop show every year called Stardust. So that's how I came to know all of the jazz greats, is from that program. And, you know, all the standards they would play each year. And he brought in all of this music, and he would bring in clinicians. And so Doc Severinsen had been coming to Clay Center for so many years before me. And in fact, when I was in high school, he was way too busy with The Tonight Show to even ever come. So I did not meet him.
But so he did meet a lot of people in your town, just
indeed,
not you.
Indeed. And he met some of my brothers and sisters, and they played with him, but not me. He was busy with The Tonight Show, and he couldn't pick up and leave at that point. But he had been there a number of times. And so then, along with the choral director, they just formed this out-of-this-world expectation of the students to, you know, okay, you have to play this song because the Mendez brothers, who are a famous trumpet duo, are going to play the solo, and you have to sound good for them. And so the students responded, and my mom has an actual old record recording of her stage band playing with the Mendez brothers.
Do you, when there was this expectation that everyone would sound good, like what you're describing, is that
yes,
there was a pretty high level of expectation,
yes,
for people in the town when these performing groups would come through. Do you remember that from your own childhood? And
I do.
And what those expectations kind of prompted you to achieve, or how you met those expectations?
Well, It was a standard that was already set. And so I think each class that came through Clay Center High School wanted to uphold the standard. And also we were still having regular guest clinicians come at all the time. And so, you know, we really just did it. We didn't think about what we were doing being amazing or something. We just knew that we needed to.
Well, we're going to hear more of the story of Vanessa Thomas, how she did eventually meet Doc Severinsen, how her career took off, when we return. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is a portrait session on KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today's show is a portrait session with Vanessa Thomas, the singer from Kansas who tours nationally with trumpet player Doc Severinsen.
There she is.
You know, sometimes when you have the blues, you don't always get the nice, cute, little, neat, royal blues. When you have the blues and you got it real bad, you get that deep, dark, ugly, navy, dark, dark, inkblot, mood
indigo blues. Always get that mood indigo since my baby said.
Hi again, Vanessa.
Hello.
So I guess you do sing jazz now.
I do.
That is from a video I found on YouTube of your appearances with Doc at a college in Illinois. I think it's called Elmhurst.
Oh, yes. Elmhurst Jazz Band.
And it seems like you guys do kind of have a circuit that includes everything from places like Elmhurst College in Illinois to places like the Kauffman Center.
Yes. And actually, Doc has always enjoyed kind of mentorship and being a clinician. And so one of his favorite things to do is to work with a college level jazz band or big band. And that's what we have done at Elmhurst several times.
How did you hook up with Doc?
Well, Doc and I met in another a most unexpected way in Clay Center. Eventually, we were both doing a concert. I mentioned the Snodgrass family, and Pauline, who was Wayne's wife, has since passed away, but she was coming up on her 99th birthday. And so all of the family, the large family, six kids, including C.L. Snodgrass, planned a concert that included the Matheny brothers and session musicians from L.A. and New York and some of the great jazz players we have in town in Kansas City, to honor Pauline, who was an avid music lover and played the piano wonderfully. And so we all gathered, and I was to sing an aria for Pauline. And a couple weeks before, I was discussing details with CL about when I would be in the program and what aria I had chosen and all of the minor things that go into putting a show together. And I said, well, do you have time for me to do a song with the big band like I did in high school? And he said, well, I wondered if you'd like to. And I said, I'd love to. And so I ended up singing Depuis le Jour, which is Charpentier from Louise. And then I sang Orange Colored Sky, which is a Natalie Cole and Nat King Cole and, an old jazz standard. And so Doc heard me doing sound check with my accompanist a couple days before the show. And he was around practicing. I could hear him. I mean, he's the loudest trumpet player in the world. And so we were on stage just running the aria. And after a while, I was almost through to the end of the piece. And I saw somebody walking in the back of the auditorium. And I thought, oh, it's probably a janitor or somebody's one of the musicians here ready to use the stage or something. So when we wrapped up, Doc had walked all the way from the back of the auditorium to the front. And he said, I thought they were testing the equipment and you were a record, which, a CD, I think he meant. And, I said, no, it's me. And he said, well, who are you? And I said, I'm Vanessa. And he said, well, where did you come from? And I said, I come from Clay Center. And he said, what? And I said, well, Doc, all the good people do. And he says, you know who I am? And I said, of course I know who you are.
Had you watched The Tonight Show and
yes,
seen him on there?
Not as much as some people, because I was little and I wasn't allowed to stay up very late. And, but I definitely recognized him. And of course, since my family had been in concerts with him and seen him in Clay Center, he was someone we had talked about growing up. But of course, I knew who he was. And so we just kind of talked for a minute and he said, well, do you do other kinds of music? And do you have some Christmas music you could sing? And this is August. So I'm like, oh, well, yes, I have some things. And I looked at the accompanist and I said, let's do the Mozart Alleluia. And so we launched into that. And he said, I like that. Can you send me a recording? So a couple days later, when we did the show for Pauline's birthday, I sang Orange Colored Sky and the aria. And afterward, he said, I didn't know you could sing jazz, too. And I said, yeah, I sing a lot of things. I like music. And so he said, well, I want you to send me a recording of some stuff, a variety of stuff. Give me what you can do. So I did it very quickly, as quickly as possible. Sent him a couple headshots.
Yeah, because that seems like a pretty incredible opportunity.
Yes.
And you were just dropping by Clay Center at this point?
Yep. I thought it'd be a nice way to visit my parents and say hi and visit Pauline for her 99th birthday. They really thought she wouldn't make it to 100, so that's why the 99 was so big. She made it to 102, of course. But yeah, so this just happened, and I'm kind of thinking to myself, well, I'll send him the info, and I'm sure nothing will come of it. But I was hasty about it. I got it in gear, sent that to him. His road manager forwarded it to Mexico, where he was living at the time. And I heard back from him in a few days, and he said, my wife, who is good friends with Marilyn Horne and an opera lover and a music lover, has listened to your CD, and she told me to hire you. And I think she's right. So I'd like to take you to Minneapolis for the holiday shows they do there. I think we did 4 that year. I walked into Orchestra Hall, few thousand people, and I sang one of my pieces, and the auditorium was silent. Like, there was no noise, and I was clearly done with my piece. And I looked over at Doc on stage, who was conducting and had finished. He looked at me, and we both just kind of froze. And in about 5 seconds, everyone shot to their feet and started yelling. And it was like a thunderous roar. I've never heard anything like it since, except when I sang in Hollywood Bowl, which is a lot more people. So that noise was an amazing moment. And I looked over at Doc again, and this time he was smiling and laughing. And he said, "You and I are going places." And he kissed me on the cheek.
Aw. What was your career like just before that moment?
Well, just before that moment, I had just done the world premiere of John Brown, which is a Kirk Meacham opera. And we premiered it in Kansas City at the Lyric Opera. And I did a walk-on role as a dual role. I was a slave and also a freed slave in the opera. Not at the same time. And so I had an aria, and it was almost like Kirk wrote it for me. It was perfect. And it was the perfect situation. And we got reviewed in several opera publications, including Opera News. And it was a great moment. And up to that point, my life was, you know, taking care of 4 children who were very young, and I did stay home with them. I gave private lessons, voice lessons on the side. And but I will say that I was ready to go when these opportunities came, because I practiced incessantly.
Well, you know, I want to get back to your training, but I'm going to stick with this Doc Severinsen thing for a minute, because that's such a huge moment that you just described, where you get this opportunity that takes you from, in some ways, like a local stage to a national stage.
Absolutely.
And also this kind of rapport with someone, a very intimate rapport with someone who had been just a legend.
Yes.
In your mind. There is a whole history of big name musicians sharing the bill with younger talent that they want to support and introduce to the world. Do you feel like you and Doc are part of that history?
Yes. And I think that his real love of mentorship is part of what brought us together. But in some ways, as soon as we met, we were just family. It was like a sudden plus one dad for me. And so I call him Papa Doc, or Pops, and he'll call me. If he doesn't hear from me, he'll call and, "How's my daughter doing?" You know? And I've been introduced on the stage many times as his daughter. And so many people come up to me after concerts and say, "Is he really your dad?" I'm like, "Well, yeah, but no, not officially." But yeah, I do think that he had an interest in furthering my career. He's really interested in young talent, and he loves to, you know, do a masterclass with young musicians of all kinds.
The relationship between just a person who works in a field of one age and then someone who's maybe a couple generations older, what that relationship is like is interesting, and it can be, I think, a really beautiful thing. I worked with a legendary broadcaster in his later years. I'm talking about Walt Bodine, who used to host this time slot.
Oh, yeah.
He was a legend in Kansas City just for years, for decades. Mm-hmm. And he had become popular at a time when people had, I think, a special relationship with the broadcasters they knew and trusted. And he operated in a world of journalism that had passed in so many ways. But by working alongside him, I got to operate in that world, got a little taste of it myself, and yeah, just got exposed to a different way of thinking about my own trade. Mm-hmm. Do you experience that touring with Doc Severinsen?
Absolutely. It's so interesting to talk about music with Doc, because for us, now he does love to talk shop and trumpet with other trumpet players, but for us, I do play 8 instruments, and none of these instruments is the trumpet. But we talk about things like the way we feel when we play a song and the breathing and the mechanics of our technique. And essentially, we find a universal language to discuss what music is to each of us. And of course, listening to him talk about his music it's like a complete gift and a secret that I'm, you know, in on that other people, you know, may never get to experience. So that part of it is really cool. And then the other part is just kind of hanging out with him as a friend slash daughter, in that, you know, we do everyday things together. We might fly somewhere and have a couple performances, and then we might drive an hour to the next venue, and then maybe drive an hour to the next venue the next day, and then fly back. And so we're road tripping, and, you know, we're just doing things like, hey, Doc, do you want a granola bar? You know, are you hungry? So it's just been a really awesome experience to know him so closely and personally.
Your career is so interesting to me in that the work you do at home in Lawrence as an accompanist and voice coach and church music director has this very, like, I hope that this doesn't sound the wrong way, but like anonymous and or humble, more like very down-to-earth quality. And then meanwhile, you have this like association with all this name recognition and the touring and the fancy venues. You know what I mean?
Yes. I think people really don't believe when they see me at the grocery store in yoga pants that I could be anyone. And I kind of like that. But at the same time, I made these choices so that I could be a present mom with my kids. And I really have enjoyed being there for them. But, you know, we can watch the Oscars and I can say, oh, there's Wayne. I played with him at the Hollywood Bowl. Or one of my favorite stories is after I sang at Hollywood Bowl, and our drummer was Carol Burnett's husband, Brian Miller. You know, I have this experience of singing for, you know, 20,000 people or 30,000 people. And I come home. And that evening, the next day, after my flight, I'm home and I'm just kind of adjusting back into normal life with my kids. And my son comes to me and he's like, Mom, I dropped my change in the toilet. And so I went from Hollywood Bowl to the toilet bowl in 24 hours. So this is kind of, you know, my everyday life. And it's just the really highs and just normalcy the rest of the time.
Tell me more about everyday life with your kids and with these different jobs you juggle.
Well, with 4 kids, it comes with a schedule. So I have to be very organized with that. And at the same time, scheduling in vocal coachings and voice lessons. Also, I have to be very careful about my scheduling. So it's more of an organizational skill than anything. I really enjoy giving private vocal coachings. And so this is something...
Who do you coach?
I coach a variety of people. In fact, one of my ex-students who studied with me, I think she began lessons in 6th grade and came to me in summers quite often and through her start at Juilliard. Got into Juilliard. I said, you need to audition for Juilliard. And she said, oh, I don't think so. And I said, I think we should try. So she got into Juilliard and she has come back to Kansas City and she'll be singing Tatiana and Eugene Onegin at the Lyric Opera. So I've done a lot of, I've had a lot of students from various backgrounds, adult, high school, middle school, who've gone to Boston Conservatory, who've gone on to Interlochen Arts Camp and Academy, who have gone on to Webster, you know, music theater schools, it's been a really interesting segment of kids and adults.
You mentioned earlier that being a mom is part of what living the dream means to you, that growing up adopted and also with serious trauma and abuse in those early months and years before you can even remember, mm-hmm. that having a family of your own, and it sounds like doing it your way, has been a dream for you all along.
Yes.
How can you tell the story of how that dream came true for you?
Well, I think it was something that I felt I needed for closure. And I know that may sound strange, but I really wanted my own kids, and I guess I wanted to make it right. And I was always interested in genetics because there are things about my family that, you know, they saw glimpses of me, and maybe it's nature and maybe it's nurture, but, you know, there are some really cool things about genetics, and I was always very interested in that. And I also wanted...
And to see some of that mirrored back at you, probably.
Exactly. I wanted to see what that would look like for me. And I did want to do it my way. I wanted to be a career woman, but I also wanted to be a mom. And it's been worth it. It's hard to do both jobs, but I've had a great time doing it.
And you're a single mom.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, divorce is something that was in the mix, and I didn't want to add it to the mix, but, you know, things get thrown in the pot and you just keep stirring.
Can you flesh that out a little bit more for me? I mean, how, because just to think about juggling your touring career with the number of different gigs you have at home without the whole mom gig, which it sounds like is a huge part of the dream that you're living, and mm-hmm. your dream is very big and you are still pulling it off.
I have a lot of friends who help, and I consistently have someone who helps me when I'm gone and just takes care of all the things that I would take care of if I were there. And then I have to give a shout out to my kids. My older daughters have been like, I call them little mom and little mom. because my two oldest daughters have just been so intuitive and helpful, and just they've been there for me when I needed them, and they had to grow up maybe a little quicker than I would have made them grow up if I could have chosen for them, but I needed their help and they were there.
How?
I would say I have 3 hours of lessons tonight. And, and even like last year when my oldest daughter was driving, I'd say, I need you to take your sister to her rehearsal. And I've already got dinner in the crock pot. Can you shut off the crock pot and serve everybody? And you guys can have dinner while I finish lessons. I mean, it's just a million little things each day that I kind of expected of them, and they came through on.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, more on how Vanessa Thomas got where she is today and a demonstration of the 4-octave vocal range that she's famous for. This is a Portrait Session, and I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Vanessa Thomas, a Kansas singer who was drawn to music at a young age. It helped her work through childhood trauma. She was raised in Clay Center, Kansas, where she was placed in foster care and then adopted. And she's gone on to a career as a touring singer who shares the bill with Grammy-winning trumpet player Doc Severinsen. She lives in Lawrence. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi.
So what we haven't talked about is the path from point A to point B. We kind of skipped that part. Can you explain that path?
Yes, let me elaborate. I was, I think, 5 when I started begging my parents for piano lessons. I say begging because I was very insistent. And then I will say I started nagging. And then I really think I full on just started having tantrums about it. I wanted to learn to play the piano. And it was, for some reason, it was everything. It was all important to me. I just knew that we were going to be friends, the piano and I. And so in Clay Center, we had just a couple piano teachers, and they did not start teaching students until second grade. So I began, I think, in the summer of my first grade year. We got to start a little bit early, and I'm sure my mom was glad because I stopped my incessant whining, and immediately I just learned to play. It was just like a duck in water. It was what I was supposed to do. I went from there to singing along with playing, which is what I had wanted to do in the first place. That was my motivation. I wanted
you were going
to
be your own accompanist.
Exactly. I wanted theme music all the time. From there, I started singing and playing, and I was unstoppable. I began doing little programs for maybe the Business and Professional Women's Club in Clay Center and Rotary and a class reunion performance. And, you know, I did these little, I had a 25-minute program beginning around age 12 where I would sing and play or just play.
How frequently?
Probably at age 12, not as frequently as around age 14. But going into high school, my ninth grade year, I probably did something once or twice a month.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you had a job.
I really did. And I looked through my scrapbooks that my mom was very conscientious in keeping. And there were hundreds of programs, hundreds. And I did weddings and funerals. And this is the way in which Clay Center embraced me. And they made sure that when my music teachers, Ken Lang, the choral director, and C.L. Snodgrass, the band director, who gave me private lessons on the euphonium for many years, when they said it was time for me to go to a camp so that I could reach the next level and be challenged, the community stepped up and they fundraised. And before I knew it, I had all of the money I needed to attend Interlochen Arts Camp. And so I did that.
In Michigan, right?
In Michigan for 8 weeks. So I
that's a very prestigious art school.
Indeed, indeed. There aren't a lot of places that you can go that are better for high school.
Performing arts in particular.
Yeah, and for doing what I wanted to do. And they do it right. You know, they do an operetta, which is appropriate for the age level. And so each year, Gilbert and Sullivan. So I walked in there and I saw people from all over the world, people who looked like me, people who didn't. No one even gave me a second thought. And I went into auditions and realized that I had to read a monologue, which I was completely unprepared for. I had to ask a few people, what is a monologue? it was interesting. And then, but the singing part, I knew that I could do that. So I walked in and sang. And
where was the audition?
The audition was in one of the sheds. I mean, we had cabins and sheds at Interlochen. It was pretty rustic. So I'm in this shed with hundreds of kids. And in fact, I think we had 170 or something in the operetta that year. And I walked in. I was 16 from Clay Center, Kansas, and I got the lead.
That is awesome.
So it was awesome and terrifying and amazing all at once. And I sang with my first orchestra at Interlochen. And so this was the beginning of me saying, I want to do this. And so I had great teaching that summer. And when I came back, I was really unclear what to do. There were scouts on the campus all the time. And I did the concerto competition at Interlochen, and I was first runner-up. And usually instrumentalists only won. And so this year, one of the runners-up was a vocalist, and it was me. And so Juilliard sent word out that they wanted me to stop at the Juilliard table, as did Eastman, as did Cincinnati, all of these major conservatories. So I stopped at the tables, and they said, well, we think we can, you know, get you a wonderful package. Come to us.
So you're being summoned by the top performing arts colleges in the country. Did that feel just like a lot to you? Really? It's all happening so fast and so suddenly, it sounds like.
Yes. And I just wasn't ready for it. I was still in small town mode. I didn't understand, you know, I looked on paper at the prices and tuition and I thought, wow, this is impossible. And that's kind of what my parents thought too. And I wasn't ready to get out in the wide world. I graduated at 17 and I went to K-State. And at K-State, I had a great experience. I loved campus. I was a very involved student as a leader, but I wasn't getting musically what I wanted. I wanted to do more opera. I wanted to delve into more styles of music.
And so you were just intimidated both by the price and the scale of those other experiences? And
yes, and I don't think I actually processed what it meant to walk into Interlaken and have a lead role. I mean, I just didn't know what that meant. And so in retrospect, graduating a year early, essentially, it gave me some time anyway. And so I decided that I was going to take a year off of college. And no one was any too pleased about this, of course. But I just felt I needed to regroup and evaluate exactly what I wanted. And so I'm working in Clay Center. And I had a full-time job at a fast food restaurant. And I get this call from a Snodgrass who lives in New York. And she said, I'm sitting here with the general manager of the Metropolitan Opera and his wife, and they need an au pair for the year. Do you want to come and do this? And I said, yes. Yes, I do.
A live-in nanny?
Yes. When would I go? And she said, well, I think they'd like you to send them some information and a resume. And, you know, I've told them a little about you, but I think you can do it. And his wife, Jean, was from Iowa. So we were both essentially farm girls. And she had worked her way up through ballet corps into the Met Opera Ballet Corps. And so she was retired and they had one daughter who was four. And so basically, I sent them information and it was in snail mail in those days. As the information was en route to them, I got a call from Jean and she said, you know, we've heard so much about you from Kathleen Snodgrass that we're just going to hire you. Can you fly in next week? And can you fly in next week? And that was more Australian than New York, but I've lost it. And so I did. And it was a whirlwind. I flew into New York, rode in on a town car and went to our apartment, which was the Met Opera general manager apartment, meaning they had taken the partitions out and it was six apartments in one. And so I had my own, you know, my own little apartment within the apartment. And I spent a year doing things with Anna, their daughter, and going to the opera no less than four times a week.
So that was your education.
that was, needless to say, probably the most, the most effective education I received. You know, when you watch Pavarotti in rehearsal and June Anderson and Marilyn Horne and Domingo, and then you go and see them in performance, you discover things about rehearsal and performance that you didn't know before. And I fine-tuned my languages. We studied with one of Pavarotti's good friends for Italian, and it just sort of unfolded.
You know, we are running very short on time, and I have promised people that they are going to hear your four-octave range.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Let's can we
see
demonstrate
what
that real
I
quick?
Can do.
And I know you might be more comfortable standing up, so if you want to quickly stand.
I probably should so I can adjust the mic.
Yeah.
Smile though your heart is aching. Smile even though it's breaking. We might sing that tune or we might sing.
Cannot believe I've never sat in front of a human being who a sound like that has been coming out of before. That was amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I think that the backstage at the Metropolitan Opera education was an effective one.
It was fun.
Our time is up. Vanessa Thomas, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for having me.
This has been a portrait session, which means this in-depth interview will be accompanied by photos from the talented Paul Andrews, online at kcur.org. And you can listen back to anything you've heard on Central Standard at kcur.org/Central Standard. It's the weekend, but you can stay in touch with us on Twitter if you like. We are at KCUR CST. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Todd Hope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. Linda Scher runs the board for us. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs, and our portrait session partner is Paul Andrews. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.